She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And I can promise you, you will have a lot to think about after this show today. Our show is made possible through the generous support of Habitat for Humanity Tucson. Habitat Humanity's goal is to build safe, decent, affordable, quality homes for people in need. And what a great job they are doing with just that. And of course, in Tucson, all of their homes are LEED certified. So we love the Habitat for Humanity. You can learn more about them by visiting their website at habitattucson.org. So on with the show. The name of our show today is Waste-Free Kitchen. And that is just what we're going to learn today, all about how to have a waste-free kitchen from one of our favorite return guests. I'm thrilled to introduce Dana Gunders. She is a staff scientist from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and she is going to discuss her latest endeavor. And while I was preparing for the show, I was thinking, okay, she is leads the work for NRDC on reducing the amount of food waste across the country. She is a wife. She is a mother. She is a pet owner. and in her spare time, she wrote a book. So, Dana, welcome to the show. Congratulations on Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, and let's get going.
Thank you, Dina. It's great to be here.
And I think we should cover, the book will be available, it's available now for pre-order, because you can't promote the book too many times, in my opinion. It's available for pre-order on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and tell us about the independent network you mentioned to me.
Yeah, there's another site it's available on called IndieBound, I-N-D-I-E, Bound, and that's kind of the independent seller bookseller's answer to Amazon. It gives you a way to find a bookseller near you and request a book through them.
And I think a lot of our listeners will love that. So my comments first, quickly, it's a great book. It's filled with really important facts about food waste. You literally lay out doable strategies for everyday life that will actually take the pressure off whoever does the cooking in the house. And you show us how to shop smarter, save money, produce less food waste. And you packed it in fun, engaging ways that are so sensible. I should definitely write a book review for up on Amazon. I love the format. So let's do an overview. What is the book about and who is it for?
Sure. The book is called Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, and the goal of the book is really to help give all of us information that we need when we're standing in our kitchens, when we're standing in the grocery store, so that we don't waste as much food as we might be wasting today. Across the country, Americans are wasting 40% of the food that we have in the country, and that has huge environmental impacts. It's a tragedy to think about when you have so many hungry people still in this country. And it's something that nobody means to do, but we all find ourselves, tossing a head of lettuce or a science experiment from the back of the fridge, every so often. Right?
Or a bag of spinach that you were going to make such a great salad.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I think on one hand, the book is hoping to raise a little bit more awareness about the fact that really all of us do waste some food. But more importantly, it's really meant to close the gap between just sort of knowing that you waste food and sometimes you're cleaning out your fridge and actually giving you the tools and information that you need so that you can make small changes to really improve upon that. So it's got everything from tips on smart shopping and how to store food and how to plan meals, as well as, what do you do with the scraps once you have them? It's got little science experiments you can do with your kids, ways to regrow food, and even a list of what you can and can't feed to your dog.
That's right, the whole circle in there. Well, what about you? I love that you describe yourself as a food waste warrior. And I guess by the time I finish the book, I believe there's a food waste warrior in all of us. When did your journey to really recognizing and getting excited about that start?
Well, you know, I grew up in a household. My father actually was raised in the Philippines, and my mother was raised in the Queens, and her parents ran a lamp store. So both from pretty simple backgrounds where they really valued food. And that means that when I was growing up, my dad was, you know, sucking the life out of the chicken bone until there was nothing left but the actual bone. And
right.
You know, my mom was putting water in the spaghetti jar to get the last little bit of sauce out of the jar. So I think a lot of it was really baked in me. But it wasn't until I became a scientist and was working on agriculture issues and really saw how many resources go into the food that we grow. You know, 80% of the water in this country goes to agriculture. And a huge, over half the land in this country is going to grow food. And so when we're not eating that, you know, it's just a huge waste of resources. And so for me, the light bulb really went off when I was looking at how do we improve farming and agriculture in this country. And I realized, gosh, you know, before we do that, why don't we actually make sure we're using all of the food that we're growing?
And, you know, what shocked me in the book, and you get to tell it, I would think that the biggest food wasters are farms where the food, you know, it's not the right shape, so leave it in the ground or in the shipping of it, and also restaurants, but not so. Who are the biggest culprits in the food waste world in the United States?
Yeah, believe it or not, it's us. It's consumers.
I know. It's like, what?
And certainly there are, you know, big chunks of food going to waste up in the supply chain before it gets to us. But collectively, as a bunch, in our homes, we're really wasting possibly about 40% of all the food that goes to waste.
It's staggering. I mean, to me, it's almost, you say almost half. That's what it feels like to me. And another little tidbit that you put in the book that I wanted to highlight is I was shocked with your data about portion sizes in restaurants or fast food places. Tell us just a little bit about that, because that is phenomenal to me about the pizza and the portion size for French fries and stuff.
Yeah, well, portion sizes have grown tremendously over the last, 40 or so years. So if you think back to the 80s, you might remember, you know, going to a bake sale and buying a cookie, and it was the size it was, and now you go into Starbucks and buy a cookie, and it's four times that size. Cookies have actually quadrupled in calories over the time period of 1982 to 2002. And they're not alone. Even a chicken Caesar salad, a slice of pizza, you know, a cheeseburger, they've all just grown in size and therefore in calories. And there's only, you know, really two things that are happening with those additional calories. Either we're eating them, which isn't particularly good,
right.
Or we're not, and they're going to waste.
They're going to waste because stuff is too big. You see portion sizes in restaurants, and it's like, are you kidding me? This is, who could eat that? Not me. So what
right.
are some of the things, the nitty-gritty of what contributes to food waste in our home? Why do we waste so much food?
Well, you know, I think it's a little different for different people.
Right.
But part of what it boils down to, in my mind, is that we're just not very realistic about what we eat. So when we're standing in the grocery store, we have great aspirations for the week. You know, we want to eat healthy. We want to try a new meal. We want to, you know, add some flavor to the week. And so we buy, you know, with that in mind. And then we get home and life happens. And, you know, by Tuesday you're exhausted and you're throwing a frozen pizza in the oven instead of cooking that great, you know, stuffed chicken meal that you were going to cook. And by Friday, some of the ingredients that you bought that you had great intentions for have already shriveled up and, you know, are getting tossed.
And it's just so refreshing to me because you just reminded me one of the things I loved about the book. It's so down to earth and so relatable and humorous. It's like we all do this. And I'm reading some of the things you say, like done, guilty, been there, yeah. done that. And then what about, is all food waste created equal, or should we as consumers try to be a little bit more mindful of not wasting foods that require expenditure of more resources? Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure, yeah, and I talk about this in the book, is that really there are some types of food that require a lot more resources than others. So when you throw out a hamburger, for instance, that's the equivalent of taking a 90-minute shower in terms of the water that was required to produce that hamburger. If you throw out an egg, it's more like an 11-minute shower. So in the book, I have a whole chart of different foods and the shower minute equivalents that it equates to, just to help people get a sense of, you know, what's really going into the food. And of course, it's not just water. It's fertilizers and, in some cases, pesticides and just the use of the soil and everything that requires. So we do put a lot into growing our food, and it does vary by type of food.
And it is that page is kind of hilarious, but so informative. Like if you throw away a pound of beef, you're throwing away the equivalent of a 370-minute shower. That is some shower, but if you want to throw away a beer, 8-ounce beer, it's only 4 minutes. But even that, it's like that's a big number.
That's right.
And if it's okay, I'd like to quickly read a paragraph because I found it really impactful for me. It's on page 18. In the end, the vast majority of food waste ends up in landfills or incinerators. In the United States, less than 5% of discarded food is composted, which to me, that's still amazing. Almost everybody I know composts. Food now represents the single largest component of municipal solid waste brought to landfills, where it also releases methane, a greenhouse gas, 34 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And if that weren't enough, it costs Americans $1.5 billion a year just to dispose of the wasted food and produce all that pollution. That's a pretty impactful paragraph. Do you want to expand on any of that? Like, it's, are you kidding me? You just think about, it's the car you're driving that's creating the CO2 emissions or other things that I would think have far greater carbon footprints, not just food waste.
Yeah, I mean, it really has a huge footprint. In fact, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization did a study, and they estimate that around the globe, if you take all of the food wasted, the footprint of all that food waste would rank number 3 if it were a country after the U.S. and China in terms of its greenhouse gas emissions.
It's just staggering. And you're the scientific researcher, so I'm buying everything you're putting out.
Well, and I think beyond that, it's really hard to believe that food is the number one product going into our landfills today. And that says something to the amount we're recycling of other products, as a positive point. But really, it's huge. It's about 20% of all of what goes into our landfills these days.
And do you think that's what most people think? I mean, I'm Mrs. Green. I did not think that was that significant a portion of our waste. It shocked me.
Yeah, I think it shocks everyone. You know, it's something that doesn't happen in big quantities, that are very visible. It's
right.
Just sort of every day, that every day we're throwing scraps. And of course, there will always be food scraps. And I think there is some good news out there about cities around and towns around the country developing programs so that people can separate their food waste and put it in a different bin and it will get composted. And that's the 5%, that's in that number right now. But it's growing quickly. And in fact, when I started writing the book, it was over only 4%. So I think, there is good news that even if you are not, willing to compost in your backyard, or maybe you don't have a backyard, that these programs will continue to see available, and that does help with the greenhouse gas emissions. I do have a little section in the book that talks about how to compost in your backyard, and also even if you're in an apartment, how to compost a little bit.
And we have something great here that some innovator entrepreneur started, and it's called Scraps on Scraps. And for $13 a month, we can put our compost in these tightly sealed buckets, and they pick it up twice a month. That is real, because for us, we have a zero-scape, you know, for our all of our property. And so we had guilt for not composting from our smoothies and our vegetables. And $13 a month can pretty much fit in anybody's budget. And it's, you know, I feel guilt-free. They're just, and they're using it as part of a project with the community food bank. So
yeah,
it is. It all fits in. I think it's important that for anybody listening, your book is really not about judgment. It's about having fun and taking small steps. Can you just expand on that a little bit? That's the underpinning of everything. Make it fun. Get engaged.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is not, you don't need to be a great cook. You know, we all have to get dinner on the table. And I think what I try to encourage in the book is just being creative in the kitchen, trying to use things up, really giving people information on how to store food. That's something that's been lost over the years, you know, just what is the right way to store food. So, for example, there's a whole section of the book where we talk about where you can look up 85 different products and learn, you know, does this go in the refrigerator? Does it not? Can I eat the green part of the strawberry? You know, what do I do with my lettuce once it gets a little bit wrinkly? And so it sort of gives ideas, but also just gives information on how to store things. And just absolutely, you know, we're all on this journey together. I actually opened the book by telling a story about writing the book. And I was sitting in a cafe one day, and I ordered a sandwich, and it came with a side of salad. And the salad was absolutely drenched in dressing. And it was just, it was too much. I couldn't eat it. And I just found such irony in the fact that here I am writing this book about how not to waste food.
But I can't eat this.
And there's no way I'm eating this salad that they just brought me.
I get it. It's like, ask for your dressing on the side.
Right, next time.
Really and truly, I've been there. It's like, I can't even taste what is under this dressing.
Yeah, so I mean, this is not about perfection. It's not about guilt. And the good news is that even if you just reduce your waste a little bit, that helps. You know, it doesn't, it's not about perfection in this. It's just about really being aware. And I believe just being aware of the issue will make a dent in it.
So I was laughing because when I was looking at the book, it says very early on, sage shopping. And I'm thinking, wow, sage. Oh, wise shopping. I really liked it. And give us some of the tricks of the trade. It's easy. It's an easy concept to grasp, but I think much harder to practice. And is it all in the planning?
Yeah, well, this goes back to, you know, the idea that we're kind of buying too much, really. You know, we're not buying to accurately reflect what we use during the week. And of course, when you're in the store, there's lots of features in the store that make it very enticing to go in and buy more than you might need. In fact, about half of all of the purchases that consumers make are unplanned.
That is not a good statistic. It's like you look and you say, oh, look, this is on sale, or, oh, look, fresh strawberries. I'll buy a crate. You know what I mean? It's very, you're seduced into what's happening in front of your eyes that's not on the list.
Exactly. And, you know, they say never go shopping hungry, but there's all these other ways, too. I mean, I do it all the time. I go in and, you know, I need some milk, and then all of a sudden there's a fresh baguette and cheese, and I go, oh, wait, that'd be great.
Gotta have that.
You know, hey, I haven't bought, you know, apples in a while, and next thing you know, $40 later, I'm walking out of the store with my milk and many other things.
And
there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
As long as you really are going to use them. I think what I try to encourage in the book is to think ahead a little bit more than some people might be thinking. You know, the industry research shows that people who use shopping lists actually spend less time in the store, they save money, and they wind up eating healthier because they, you know, are sticking to what they planned. So definitely, I encourage people to use shopping lists to plan their meals ahead. And when I say plan their meals ahead, I don't mean sit down with a cookbook on Friday night.
And write out all your recipes.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, very much a reality check there. So I encourage people first. I mean, in my own life,
okay,
I
hold
only
that
plan.
Thought. We are up on the first break already. Everybody,
okay, sure.
Stay with us. Waste Free Kitchen Handbook. Dana Gunders is our guest. Lots more to come.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at mrsgreensworld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at mrsgreensworld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the Igloo radio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmer Glass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@mrsgreensworld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
In the mid-Tucson summer, you would expect it to be over 100 degrees. But deep beneath the University of Arizona's compost heap, temperatures can hit 160. Started by the Compost Cats student group, the U of A Compost Project is collecting tons of waste from around campus and keeping it out of landfills. Gathering garbage and converting it into a useful product for the community? Now that's a hot idea indeed. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. The name of our show today is Waste Free Kitchen. Our guest is Dana Gunders, a staff scientist from the Natural Resources Defense Council, discussing her soon-to-be-released book, The Waste Free Kitchen Handbook, A Guide to Eating Well and Saving Money by Wasting Less Food. It will be released on September 29th, but you can pre-order it on Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, and at a new website that I learned about, IndieBound, for independent, for authors that want to use an alternative. That's what I liked about that. So a little bit more about Dana. She works on food waste. She's been featured on CNN, NBC, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, NPR, and of course on Mrs. Green's World. Dana, it's great to have you with us again to learn about your book and why it's so important on so many levels. So you were talking about planning and not having to sit down Friday night and spending 2 hours planning for the week ahead and getting your recipe books out. Nobody's going to do that unless they don't have a life, maybe.
That's right. Right. So in my book, I do talk about meal planning. And what I suggest is, first of all, plan some lazy nights in. You know, whatever works for your lifestyle. But I personally have about 3 lazy nights planned into my week.
I loved that. There's a guide, and it says lazy night. And I'm like, I love this woman. Lazy night.
That's the night when you're too tired to cook and you throw, you know, the frozen pizza in the oven, or you order takeout, or you last minute decide to go out with friends to eat. You know, it's really just acknowledging that in our lives we do that. And so let's just put that in there. It's one less night you have to plan anyways. And then 1 or 2 nights, pick your favorite meals. There's this interesting theory called diversification bias that basically says that we think we want to eat a lot of variety when, in fact, we actually just like the usual stuff we like to eat. So acknowledge that in your week, you know, if it's spaghetti and meatballs or whatever it is, you know, just plan that in. And then, you know, you get to another part where maybe you do want to try a few new things, or maybe you just want to make those things that you cook a little bit easier. So I suggest, you know, buying some vegetables and whatever else you're, you know, some grains, maybe meat if you eat meat, and buying those and then preparing them at the beginning of the week. Prepare a vegetable medley that you can use as a side 1 week. You can throw into your pasta dish the next night, and then 3 nights later you can actually put that into chicken enchiladas, and you don't have to start from scratch every night. So a lot of it is just about actually making your cooking easier. And it does, of course, translate to having a shopping list and being more prepared when you're at the store as well.
Start with the planning. But there's another thing. There are quite a few things where I have lots of arrows and exclamation points and say, be sure to ask Dana about this.
But I think you really do. It was shocking to me about demystifying the freezer. I think you should talk about a little bit about that, the refrigerator demystified and how important it is, like where you put things and what should be on the lower shelves and what should be on the upper shelves, not just shoving it in. Can you talk about that a little bit? I'm like, wow.
Sure. Yeah, well, when I first started researching this book, I didn't really realize that there was a particular way that refrigerators are supposed to be used. And, you know, in the restaurant world, chefs know this well. People who work in restaurants will know that you put meat lower down and, you know, eggs higher up and things like that. But I had no idea. And so in the book, I include a diagram and an explanation of just, you know, what those crisper drawers are for, you know, what goes right in those drawers and why are they there, as well as the cheese drawer and what should be put in the door and what should not be put in the door. For instance, eggs, you know, some older models of refrigerators have a place for eggs in the
right
door of the refrigerator,
right,
when in fact that's actually the warmest part of your refrigerator because every time you open it, it gets warmed up. And that's really not a good place to put eggs.
And it always was on the top right hand when you open the door of little egg places.
Right. So that section of the book talks about, you know, where to put what in the refrigerator, as well as things like keeping your refrigerator at 40 degrees and how to know if it is. You know, above 40 degrees, you kind of get into this danger zone where bacteria can grow. And if you keep it below 40 degrees, that's where you're really preserving your food in a safe way that's going to make it last longer. And a lot of refrigerators don't actually have, a thermometer in them. And so I suggest buying a thermometer if you don't have one to really make sure that you're staying. And these things cost, I don't know, $5 max.
Right. Right. And might help you from getting really sick because food poisoning is not any fun, especially from eggs. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say that brings up a great point and one that I talk about quite a bit in the book, and that is getting sick from food. I think a lot of people throw food out because they're worried that it's going to make them sick. And so there's a whole chapter in the book called Can I Eat It? That really tries to explain a little bit about what makes you sick from food and what doesn't. And it breaks out things, you know, visual signs on food that are really harmless that people might think make them sick but really don't. Like, for instance, a wrinkled tomato or a little bruise on something or
right,
even yellow or brown spots on your lettuce or sour milk. Those things tend to be generally harmless, whereas something like mold can make you sick. And I think understanding that and understanding why, kind of what's behind potentially getting sick from food is a really empowering set of information that ultimately helps you use more food and use it better in your kitchen.
You know, one of the things on this journey for me of Mrs. Green is everything is connected. All the dots are connected. And when I do public speaking, I say pretty much anything you do has an impact on the environment, from brushing your teeth to, you know, driving your car, and the beat goes on. One of the things that is another good takeaway, keep the refrigerator door shut. Do you know how many times I have stood there with the door open, poured my club soda or gotten some milk? And in your book, it's like, don't do that. I don't think I will ever do it again. It says leaving the fridge door open when you pour milk into your cereal wastes 7% of a fridge's energy, according to Home Energy Magazine. And this, again, that's the same as what, 830 to 2,060 watt light bulbs each year? I mean, 830 to, it just blows me away. So the takeaway for me is don't stand there with the refrigerator door open. Get what you want and close it.
That's right. And, you know, if that's hard for you because you can't remember what's in there, then sometimes having a little whiteboard on the front of your fridge to remind you of the key things you want to eat can help you not stand there with it open.
And can you talk a little bit about moving up in the refrigerator, the freezer? Why do so many of us, with the best of intentions, put things on there and there, even label it, and then end up like throwing it away, if we're lucky, 3 months later or 4 months later. How can you help us not do that?
Well, I can only do so much, but...
Guide us, Dana, guide us.
Well, I think part of the trick of actually, using what's in your freezer is planning those lazy nights in. You know, planning a night where I'm just not going to plan a meal, but rather I'm just going to go forage in my freezer and use whatever I put in there last week or last month. So really sort of setting aside nights to actually use what's in there. Also, if you forget what's in there, again, having a whiteboard that you just put on the front of your freezer and listing it can help. Another thing is just making sure you're freezing food right to give you a little bit longer to use it. You know, if you're just going to pop something in the freezer for a few days, then it doesn't really matter that much how you freeze it. And that's something I do a lot when I, you know, just am not going to get around to eating something. I'll just put it in the freezer and then a few days later remember, oh, I had brown rice in there because I cooked too much the other day. So that's, but if you're going to store it for much longer or you're the type of person who might forget what's in your freezer, it's really important to make sure that you're storing it well so that it doesn't get all freezer burnt. And then even if you do leave it there for 3 months, you could still use it.
Right.
And so the book does have tips on how to freeze food. And in fact, in that section I mentioned with 85 different products, there's a little tab in each for each product about how do you freeze this food best.
It's such a hands-on book. That's what I kept saying. This is so applicable and practical and doable. And the other thing is, when you do put it in the freezer, like when we have company is when we make the most food because there are only two of us now, and we'll put a whole bunch of stuff in the freezer, and we should put it into portions because when we're going to eat it, there are probably only going to be two of us. So don't freeze all the meatballs that are left over. You know, freeze enough for what you're going to eat in those portions. I thought that was great information to be reminded of.
Yep, that's right. And I like to suggest people use either, depending on what you're freezing, ice cube trays for things like bouillons and herbs or muffin tin for things like chili or, you know, something. A muffin tin, that muffin size is a great single serving portion. And so if you freeze something in there and then you pop it out and put it into, you know, a zip-top bag or something like that, that actually helps you freeze it into the right portions as well.
Okay, another shocker in the book for me, and it's absolutely and positively spot on, because this is not me. I am not the audacious canner, pickler, drying food. Not, probably never going to be. I'll be 65 in December. Don't see myself doing it, but lots of my friends are canning, and they're making things, planning ahead. Is it trending upwards?
It is, absolutely. And it's in the millennial age range as well. A lot of young people are starting to can.
That is so great.
It is great. And it's so much easier than I thought it was. I'm not someone who had done much canning either. And I guess it just seems really complicated to me. But actually, once you've done it once or twice, any of your friends will note, it's actually really straightforward. And I particularly was surprised at how easy it was to pickle things, because I'm a big pickle lover. So It's not hard at all. I mean, you know, pickling something basically entails boiling salty water and pouring it over the vegetable you've chosen to pickle and, you know, storing it for a week or so. So it was so easy, and it's not something that I go into detail in the book, but I did want to include it in there because certainly it does help. You know, it is something you can do when you have too much food, when you have food you're not going to use, and it helps prolong its use. But of course, there are books on how to can and such, so I just give a little taster in there. And then, you know, if people are interested, they can find out more.
And it raises the consciousness. I mean, you see mason jars in the supermarkets like never before. There's, you know, you can buy a case of mason jars, and they're stacked high. And it's really definitely, obviously, a comeback. Let's talk about, this is another one that I love. In my book, I have a chapter called it's my part, it's your party, and I'll cry if I want to, about waste. You say party hard, waste light. Talk about entertaining, because we see it all the time and we all do it, where we prepare to feed an army because God forbid we should run out of food.
That's right. We do. We do all do it. And I think, you know, particularly around the holidays, we see
right.
a huge uptick in how much food gets wasted because of that. You know, some of the suggestions I include around parties are having frozen food that you're going to cook. So let's say you have a bunch of hors d'oeuvres. Make them ahead of time, freeze them, and then reheat them in batches as your party goes on so that you don't have a huge number of little quiches that you cooked and nobody's eaten. Another thing is to, ahead of time, before the party, make sure you have leftover containers that you could actually send people home with. Because I think people that attend a party can be sort of shy, or it's not really considered appropriate to ask to take food home, no matter how much extra is left over at a party. But if the host offers, many people will take it home.
And it feels great. I mean, I have been to parties lately that they, no, take it home because we're not going to eat it. And then you have dinner for another night, for a lazy night that you've planned out on Sunday. It's a really
exactly.
great. It's very, very, very simple and very easy to do. Let's not get off the whole thing about food waste without the conversation about expiration dates. And I think on one of the shows that you were a guest for me before, you talked about the surprising truth about expiration dates. It's really almost disgusting because I consider it a major marketing ploy in many cases. Maybe that's a little bit extreme, but what's your spin on the truth about expiration dates?
Well, the truth about expiration dates is that they are not meant to tell us to throw our food away. And they are not meant to indicate that the food is bad or unsafe to eat. Really what they are manufacturer suggestions for when the food is at its best, freshest quality, but not to say you can't eat it after that. They're also not regulated. A lot of people think that the government has something to do with those dates, and the only product that's federally regulated is infant formula.
Wow.
To carry a use-by date. Other than that, there are no federal regulations around it. Different states have come up with different regulations around it, but it's a real mishmash, and it's not clear that any of those are, you know, keeping consumers in those states any safer. So I think the thing to remember is that those dates, you know, they do help us navigate the food. They help us give us a sense of when it's at its freshest, but you can use food after those dates. And for instance, milk is a really good example. It does carry a date in Montana. That date is supposed to be 12 days after pasteurization. But in most states, it's 28 days after,
wow.
21 to 28 days after pasteurization. So, you know, the date can be a bit arbitrary, really. So it really depends. Milk is one product that actually is very unlikely to get you sick even if you eat it after the date, and a product where the sniff test can be very useful and accurate.
And I love even, it. I love it. Does this smell good? Can we eat this?
Yes. That's right. And even after milk has soured, it's still usable. And in the book, I do have, there are about 20 recipes in the book, and one of them is a recipe for sour milk pancakes, because sour milk can be used to bake once it's no longer really tasty to drink.
It's really, I really laughed out loud a little bit about that. And there's no, we're going to have to take another break in about a minute, but there's no really scientific research and data behind the setting of expiration dates. Aren't they, for the most part, arbitrary or suggestions? Is that an oversimplification?
Well, you know, it just varies by product. Some companies do send their products to labs and have the sugars tested, or, you know, sometimes it's about the color. It may be about the texture changing. They may have come across those dates by doing consumer focus groups and asking people when they taste a difference in the product. But it's not, it's generally not about the safety of the food. A couple products to be safe with and probably listen to those dates are deli meats and bagged salads, actually. Those are two to pay attention to.
Very good information. And we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, since all food waste in the home starts with shopping, a couple more guidelines, and we have to talk about buying funny fruit. We'll be right back. Waste diagnostics, you name it. Dana Gunders, please stay here with me, everybody.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Do you dare to share? In 2009, the University of Arizona started its car sharing program. Today, students, faculty, and staff have access to a shared fleet of cars that includes 7 hybrids and even the zero-emissions Nissan Leaf. Not only does car sharing give the campus community wheels, but it takes all those extra cars off the road, too. Now that greens things up, doesn't it? The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. So happy to welcome back a favorite Mrs. Green's World guest, Dana Gunders. Dana is a staff scientist from the Natural Resources Defense Council and author of the soon-to-be-released Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, a guide to eating well and saving money by wasting less food. I mean, people, is there a downside in any of that conversation? It's like you're going to love this book. And Dana, I just want to comment again on how you package the book. It's just so, you know, it's packed in with good stuff and humor and how to and make a list and diagrams. And it's like you want to turn the page because these are things you can do. And one of the most important takeaways for me is make it fun. Any kind of cooking that you do with grandchildren, in my case, or children can really be fun and educational as well. So thanks for taking this big thing on. And I hope it tops the bestseller list in about 5 days. So let's put that out there, okay?
All right.
There's a lot more that I want to talk about, but talk a little bit more about getting scrappy. And I just want to read this one thing. By now, you're a food waste warrior black belt and are probably down to the discarding mere scraps in your kitchen. Talk about that and how important it is to get rid of scraps properly.
Sure. Well, no matter how well we do on wasting less food, there will always be food scraps. There will always be the banana peels and the chicken bones and
right. All
of that. So in Getting Scrappy chapter, we talk about, well, first we start off talking about the hierarchy of sort of reduce, reuse, recycle. And really trying to think about, you know, what is the best use of those scraps. And one idea is to feed some of them to any pets that you might have. And so we have charts about what's safe and what's harmful to your cats and your dogs and even your chickens, if you have chickens. And then we get into other kind of fun experiments that you might want to do here and there with your scraps. So we talk about how to regrow food from your scraps, for instance, that you can take onions and put them in some water, and they'll grow roots. And like your scallions, if you think about the green onions or scallions that you
right.
have, they have little roots at the bottom. And if you, after you've cut up and used those scallions, you can actually plant that little end, and it will regrow a scallion for you. So we have little tips about that. And then we spend a lot of time talking about composting and how to do it in your backyard, how to do it in an apartment even, should you be in an apartment or somewhere without a backyard. And then we do have some other fun uses, like how to make Easter egg dye out of food scraps as well.
It is fun. It's really fun. And I think that it shocked me about the do's and don'ts for your pets with reasons that you would not necessarily think. I don't think every dog owner, most of my dog owner friends are pretty no table food. You know what I mean? They're just like, no, don't do it. But some of them, like you say, don't have them have cooked bones because it can splinter and cause internal punctures. Well, there's, you know, give the dog a bone. But no, don't give the dog a bone, and certainly don't give him any chocolate.
Right. Yeah, so chocolate, macadamia nuts, some random foods that you wouldn't really know, grapes and raisins, avocados. None of those should be given to your pets. But oatmeal, peanut butter, salmon is one that I actually, before I did this book, I thought you weren't supposed to give to your pets, but apparently that is safe. So yeah, exactly. It's just trying to lay that out for people. I was actually surprised that there was such a debate when I was researching this on raw bones and whether or not you should give those to your dogs. And really, in the book, I just frame what that debate is because I'm not really qualified to take a stance on it.
Really, it's great. And what about your spin on garbage disposals? I mean, I think they're probably wonderful. We put like our lemons after we use them, the lemon rinds and all, the lemon skin. What is your advice to all of us about the in-sink garbage disposal?
You know, you got to sort of sit back and think about where it goes, which I think a lot of people don't realize.
Really
when
important.
You put it in,
yes.
When you put garbage in your garbage disposal, it goes into your sewer. And so it goes to the wastewater treatment plant. That, you know, wherever your other sewage goes. And so generally speaking, water treatment plants are treating that in a way that's better than if it went to landfills. So I certainly rank garbage disposals above landfills. And if you don't have the ability to compost for whatever reason, it's really not a bad alternative. The only thing to keep in mind is that it does use quite a bit of water. And so if you can run your disposal kind of while you're doing dishes or just be really cognizant of not using too much water, particularly out here in the West, that's a good idea.
It's all connected. It's that whole thing about, I talk about us being in consumer comas, and it's not intentional, but it's really important that we get out of them because food waste is a big, big, big and becoming bigger issue. Okay,
mm-hmm.
What about... I'm trying to. There's so many more things I want to talk about, so cannot possibly cover the book from cover to cover. So let's do a couple of recaps. Can I eat it? What about the smell? Is that a good one? You mentioned it briefly, but is smell a good barometer for if you should throw it out or not?
Well, it kind of depends on the food. So,
like for milk, you said it's okay.
For milk, it's okay. For foods like deli meats and ready-made sandwiches that you get in the store, those are products to be pretty careful with. But something, most of your leftovers and your milk and dairy, those can typically, use your senses, not just your smell, but your sight. And, if they feel slimy, don't necessarily eat them. But, if they look okay, they smell okay, they feel okay, they're most likely okay to eat. I do recommend that with leftovers, you reheat them, particularly if they've been in your fridge longer than 3 or 4 days, you should really make sure to reheat them well so that if there were, any little bacteria growing on them, they would be killed most likely.
I know. And let's talk about the recipe section. And I just, your sense of humor so came out. I mean, this is a scientist, people, and she's a really funny scientist. So in the recipe section, it says there are 20 recipes. They're arranged by meals of the day, blah, blah, blah. But don't stop here. The fun of using things up lies in the wild creativity you can justify unleashing in your kitchen. There's the warrior. The food warrior is out. Dill cream sauce made from leftover pickle juice, anyone? So how did you decide on 20 recipes? And is there a Dana Gunders favorite?
Well, 20 recipes because, you know, it really is in part just meant to get your mental creative juices flowing on just reusing food. And actually in the book I talk about the use it up mindset quite a bit. And just, so it's really meant to get your brain in that frame of mind. So half of the recipes are kind of basic recipes that just help you use up food. So there's one in there that's called Free for All Frittata.
And loved it.
It's, you know, a basic recipe for a frittata that you can throw whatever you have in your fridge, throw into it. You know, it says, you know, take some veggies, whatever you got, some cheese if you got any, and meat if you want it, and put it in and make this recipe. And so about half the recipes do that, frittata, soup, fried rice, tacos, you know, things like that. The other half take a particular product that often goes to waste and tries to give you an idea of how to use it. So, for instance, one of my favorites is the buried
avocado chocolate mousse. Yes, that's I want to ring the bell. It's like, did she really make this and eat it?
It is so good. So it's a recipe to use overripe avocados. And, you know, I think it is such a bummer when you go and you spend $1, $1.50 on an avocado and then somehow it gets overripe before you're able to use it. And everyone thinks about guacamole in that situation, but I think this is even better. It's a chocolate mousse that substitutes avocado for a lot of the butter and cream that's typically in chocolate mousse. It is downright delectable. I make it all the time, and it's delicious.
And it is avocado and yogurt and, you know, either agave or maple syrup and cocoa powder. I mean, this is one I'm going to try. What about, I love the names you came up with. You're not going to find these in normal recipe books. Sneaky black bean brownies. Did you make that up or did you find it somewhere?
This is actually a recipe that came from my mother-in-law. My husband is part Cuban, and so he grew up eating a lot of beans, and she makes a lot of beans. And she'll make extra black beans and make these brownies with them. And it's actually a gluten-free recipe. So this substitution of beans for some of the flour that gets used. And they are so good, and she has been making them for us for years, and we love them, and so I thought I'd include her recipe in the book. And it gives you something to do with extra black beans.
And who wouldn't want to serve that to friends and say, guess what you're eating, guys? Sneaky black bean brownies, and we're having buried avocado chocolate mousse for dessert. Talk about being a party circuit hit. And then last but not least, one that really gave me a chuckle is infused vodka. Because you say, on the road to less food waste, there is definitely time for a cocktail. So tell us about making vodka.
Yes, well, I think, you know, for those of us who like cocktails, having infused vodka sounds very fancy, and particularly if you've made it yourself. But it's actually very simple to make. It really mostly involves just picking which kind of fruit or herb you want to infuse it with and pouring the vodka over it, essentially. And so we give some suggestions of which types of food can be used to infuse your vodka and how to prepare them. And, you know, just encouragement that it makes for a great cocktail.
It's just really, it does. It's another fun part of the book. So let's talk about part three of the book where I say you pull it all together. It's like where you'll turn the most once you get the book, and it's the directory. So tell us about the directory and what people can learn there. Lots of really helpful tips on storing fruits and vegetables, extending the life, and all of that stuff. So can you give us a few highlights from that?
Sure. Well, As I mentioned, the directory has about 85 or so products in it, and it's listed product by product. So you can look up apples, you can look up avocados, you can look up fish and eggs, and really learn about how long does this last, and how, you know, is it supposed to go in the fridge or not? I think, and then some tips on how to use it. So, for instance, I didn't realize that you actually should put avocados, back to your expensive avocado, in the fridge once it's ripe, and then it won't get to that overripe stage.
And it won't affect the taste either. That's what I think is so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or that strawberries actually store best if you lay them flat on a single layer on a container. And if you have too many to do a single layer, then you put a cloth in between layers. But that helps them last longer. And then other things, I mean, I learned a lot researching this section, that whole wheat flour and nuts are actually supposed to be stored in the refrigerator.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I didn't either. And I guess, you know, they do have oils in them, and so it helps those oils stay fresher. And oil's another thing. You know, since I researched this book, I actually have been buying my oil in much smaller quantities because I didn't realize that I've been using oil that had been slightly rancid, and that it's a product that really actually tastes a lot better when it's fresh. So there is, you know, a lot of information to help you not waste food, but it's also about how do you, you know, get the best taste and freshness out of the food that you're buying.
And how do you use it up and revive it? And the thing about oil is such a noteworthy component to answer, because look at the sizes that they sell in the grocery store for cooking oil. And hopefully most of us are not using much in our cooking at all anyway, because it's not one of the top five health foods that we should be drenching our food with. I think that's another good point. What about, I always like to know, inside the author's head, do you have a favorite part of the book or a particular chapter that was more fun or even the most challenging to write?
Interesting. Well, I did enjoy, like I said, researching the whole directory because I just learned so much about food, and I realized how much there is to learn about how to store and how to use your food. So I found that quite fascinating. And probably my favorite chapter, and this goes back to the scientist in me, I guess, is the Can I Eat It chapter. Because I felt like it was really important to get at kind of why does food go bad, and why does food occasionally, rarely, make people sick? And, you know, what are the different ways that it can kind of start to age, and is that actually bad for you? So I kind of, you know, the geek in me really enjoyed doing that chapter.
And it's a great chapter. And I think it's, you know, I want to say to everybody, get the book and certainly start out by paging through it and then go read it from beginning to end, because there are little bits of just jewels, precious, precious jewels. Did your family have fun while you were writing it? Your husband and your daughter, were they part of the experiments?
Well, my daughter was just born a few months ago, so
that's right. I forgot that.
Yeah, but my husband is. He is the chief food waste warrior in the house. Actually, he's got so many tips that I am going to put in book number two, and he does not hesitate to point them out to me. His favorite is taking the crumbs and the bag of tortilla chips, and he pours them into a bowl, and he pours salsa on it, and sometimes cheese, and we'll stick it in the microwave and sort of make this like nacho cereal.
Oh my gosh, that's a great idea. I love that. Yeah. And what do you do with the quarter of the bag that's all chips? So everybody, we are going to have to bring this show to an end, which makes me sad. The call to action for our listeners, pre-order the book. Again, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, or IndieBound, which I think is a really great suggestion. It's Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook by Dana Gunders, A Guide to Eating Well and Saving Money by Wasting Less Food, and it will be officially released on September 29th. Dana, thank you, and I have an announcement that I'm really excited about. This Tuesday at 7 p.m., I'm getting to interview one of the people I admire most on the planet, Seth Godin. He's been a business guru for me, and it's a one-on-one with Seth Godin and Mrs. Green Tuesday at 7 p.m. I hope you'll join us. Everybody, make it a great green week. Dana, thanks for making our world a safer, healthier place. And I forgot about the baby being a newborn. So congratulations on it. Everybody, sign up for being a part of Mrs. Green's World on my website. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.